The views and opinions expressed on this show do not necessarily reflect the views of 104.1 KQTH or the E.W. Scripps Company.
Since 1775, generations of Americans have fought for our ideals and our principles. American warriors secured the freedoms to create the United States of America. They fought to end slavery. They joined with allies to win two world wars. They have responded with valor and honor whenever called. And they have liberated more people around the globe than any military in the history of the world. Our all-volunteer forces of guardsmen, soldiers, sailors, marines, airmen, and reservists continue the mission begun at Lexington and Concord. Less than 1% of Americans serve in our armed forces. The least the rest of us can do is to pay attention and get engaged. This program is produced and broadcast for that purpose. It is presented live and worldwide at 1041kqth.com. To engage, call 520-751-1041. The American Warrior is on the air.
Welcome to American Warrior Radio, ladies and gentlemen. This is Ben Bueller Garcia. Very pleased to be spending the next hour with you. It is one of the oldest law enforcement agencies in our nation and ranks among the most elite in the world. The Secret Service was formed on July 5, 1865 as part of the Department of Treasury with the mission of combating the widespread counterfeiting of U.S. currency. In 1901, as a result of the assassination of President William McKinley, Congress requested the Secret Service to take responsibility for the protection of U.S. presidents. In 1902, two men were assigned full-time to the White House detail. Now, most likely when you picture a Secret Service agent in your mind, you think of a man. Part of the reason for this might be because for much of our history, federal regulations prohibited women employees from carrying firearms. That prohibition was quietly lifted on September 15, 1970, and on the same day, the Secret Service set a precedence among federal law enforcement agencies when they appointed the first female officer to the Executive Protection Service. It remains a role predominantly populated by men. Less than 10% of the special agents are female. Today, we're going to talk to one of them. Melanie Lentz was 22 years old when she joined the Secret Service, one of the youngest female agents ever hired. She spent her first 8 years assigned to the Los Angeles field office working fraud and intelligence investigations. She was then reassigned to former First Lady Nancy Reagan's protection detail, serving until Nancy Reagan died. Melanie was the only agent in the embalming room with Nancy Reagan and the only female pallbearer at her funeral. Welcome to American Warrior Radio, Melanie Lentz.
Hi, well, thank you for having me.
Well, Melanie, this is going to be exciting. We've only had one former Secret Service agent on the show in the 5 years I've been doing this before, and certainly never a female Secret Service agent.
Oh, well, I'm glad to be here.
Let's start off with a little bit about you, Melanie. What, from your own admission, based on what I've read about you, you were shy, introverted, you know, kid in the back of the classroom, very bright. But what inspired someone like you to join the Secret Service?
Right. Well, like you said, I've always been an introverted person, kind of one of those bookworm types. But like many men and women in college years, I had no idea what I really wanted to do with my life. I knew I wanted to do something meaningful with my life. I wanted to make my living doing something that, you know, for the greater good kind of thing. That was my attitude, and I just wasn't sure where my calling was. And I grew up in a very patriotic family. Both my mom and my dad's side have a lot of military experience. So we always grew up, you know, very, very patriotic. And so when I was getting ready to graduate from college and I went into grad school, my grandpa is the one who originally suggested it. And he's a former Army Airborne guy. And one of his buddies had a daughter who was an agent. And the dad's proud. And so they're sharing these crazy cool stories about this woman, you know, traveling all over the world and protecting foreign dignitaries and all these awesome things she was doing. And my grandpa said, you know, Mel, you are a college athlete. You're smart. Like, you should apply. You would be good at this. And my introverted self thought, well, you know, I don't have those bulky biceps and, you know, the aviators and the cop hair. You know, what in the world do you think I would, you know, what do I have to offer?
Well, Melly, what is cop hair?
Cop, I don't know.
Okay,
you know it when you see it, you know.
Okay,
that
fair
was
enough.
Military cop. Anyway, so I started kind of reading about the agency and hearing more about this, you know, buddy's daughter and her adventures, and I thought, well, that would be an awesome job. And it took me forever to fill out this application, just meticulously going through each of the essay questions and all that good stuff. But I didn't really hold my breath when I submitted it. You know, I say, well, I didn't take it that seriously. I took the application seriously, but I really didn't think they were going to call me. I thought they'd say, you know, little girl, go get some life experience. You know, you're 22 years old. What are you doing? But I guess they saw something in me because slowly but surely I started passing written tests, you know, interviews, panel interviews, polygraphs, and before I knew it, I realized, well, this could be a reality, and I needed to do a bit of soul searching. How am I going to pass this? Because I really don't have any experience. And I decided that what I had to offer at that point in time, being so young, was that I was very trainable. You know, I didn't have the experience, but I had the bones. I had the work ethic. I had the you know, moral compass, and I knew that I was going to give 110% to any job I ended up taking. And so I think that that served me well, in that I went into training knowing you don't know much, but so you need to soak up all of this experience and knowledge like a sponge when you get in there. So I was so excited and so scared, but it was almost a bit of a shock to me that they called and said, Melanie, we have a position here in Los Angeles. Do you want it? You leave for training in 3 weeks.
Wow.
And my 22-year-old self, you know, immediately said yes and thought, what am I getting myself into? But that started a 9.5-year adventure for me, and one that taught me a lot about life and in general, and so I'm very grateful for that experience. But it ended up being one of those things that I just thought was, hey, that'd be a great, cool thing to do. And, you know, I maybe underestimated myself a little too much, because I ended up making it.
Well, now, Melanie, we're going to talk a little bit about an article you wrote about some of your time in training, but I don't want to make the assumption that you, as a shy bookworm 22-year-old female, was an outlier. Do you have a sense? I mean, what kind of profile is the Secret Service looking for? Is there a punch list, or is it just really kind of what you said? They're looking for people that are trainable, who have the passion, who want to learn, and a good moral compass.
Right. Well, the minimum requirements when I got hired were you had to be 21 years old with a college degree or equivalent experience, like military or law enforcement. So those are the kind of the basic, you know, nuggets they were looking for. But I'll give you an example of how I felt, you know, that first day of training. The instructors walk in, we're all standing there, and mind you, the things that were review to a lot of my class, like standing in formation, things like that, that I had never done. So I'm already feeling, you know, lost a little bit trying to, you know, work this out. The instructors walk in and they say, former military, raise your hand. Half of the class raises their hand. And then they say, former law enforcement. And then the rest of the class raises their hand. And then there's me and maybe one other person that don't have either. So every time there was a new batch of instructors, that question would be asked, and then they would have to, of course, single you out and say, all right, well, what's your background? And me being 22 had very little background except college and, you know, lifeguarding. So I always kind of felt like, oh, I'm a little behind here. But I think most of my class had military and law enforcement experience, but all of us were patriotic type A personalities who gave 110%. So that's something we all kind of had in common, but I definitely was the younger outlier. I always felt like the younger outlier in training, for sure.
Melanie, how many women were in your training class?
There were three of us in my class. One had military and law enforcement experience and was quite a bit older than me, and the other one, I believe, had law enforcement experience and was also a little bit older than me. So three of us in our class of 24, so okay. A little higher than the average total in that class, but there was three.
Okay, when we come back after the break, Melanie, I want to get into a little bit more detail on your article, Command Presence, and the infamous Red Man, which some of us have encountered at some point in our life. But just to clarify, the training doesn't differentiate between genders. Men and women have to go through the exact same training, correct?
That's right.
There you go. Folks, as your host, Ben Bueller Garcia. We're joined by Melanie Lentz. Melanie is a retired female Secret Service agent. She's got a book coming out pretty soon. I think you're going to enjoy this. Stick around.
Those who expect to reap the blessings of freedom must, like men, undergo the fatigue of supporting it. Now, back to the American warrior.
Welcome back to American Warrior Radio, ladies and gentlemen. We're joined by former Secret Service agent Melanie Lentz. You can find out more about what Melanie is doing now. Visit MelanieLentz.com. That's MelanieLentz.com. Melanie, before the break, we're talking about an article you wrote that I really enjoyed titled Command Presence. And it was sort of a revelatory time in your training. We discussed you're sort of an introvert, sort of shy, sort of quiet, but when it comes time to protect folks, that doesn't always work. And one of the tools that law enforcement uses very often, as you said, the command presence. It's the tone of your voice. It's your presence with the way you want to make sure the folks know that you're the one in charge there. And just sort of walk us through that little kind of that transition when a different sort of Melanie emerged when faced with the red man.
Right. Well, during training, I had the luxury of being young when it came to the fitness stuff. You know, I did pretty well with that. And, you know, written tests, I was always the bookworm. So I did okay in that regard. But when we got into those mat rooms where we would practice the fighting and the handcuffing and all that kind of stuff, the instructors felt I was deficient in my command presence, you know, this authority figure. You know, I'm not as big as a lot of the guys in the class. I'm not as old as a lot of the guys in the class. And I would think to myself, I'm giving 100%. I'm fighting with all of my heart kind of thing. And early on in training, we had to do a baton test. Agents are issued those collapsible ASP batons. Luckily, I never had to use it in the field except to, you know, retrieve my cell phone from a side of, like, a car or something. So, thankfully, I never had to whack anybody with them, but it definitely hurts if you do, I hear.
Mm-hmm.
But we had to pass a test, and there's technique and ways to keep people at bay. After, you know, you have to be able to protect your protectee, so I have to be proficient at this. And the instructors just seem to be just getting on me in practice, just constantly, you know, might as well give up, you know, I don't believe you, I can't hear you, you know, how they kind of taunt you and mess with you. And I was getting frustrated because I thought, I'm screaming, you know, what is going on here? And so I was very, very nervous going into test day. I thought, you know, it doesn't matter at this point. They already think I'm going to fail. This is my last day. You know, the perfectionist doom and gloom mentality going into a test. But I remember when it was my turn to go. I was we always went alphabetically, and my last name is Lentz, which puts me kind of in the middle. So half my class had gone, and I'm watching them, you know, just thump this red man, this guy and this instructor in this full padded red suit. So we wail on this guy, and he's our assailant. He's coming to try to kill our protectee, and we have to stop him. So I'm watching my classmates just do this so well, and I'm nervous. And the guy calls me up, the instructor. He tells me my scenario, which is something to the effect of, you know, your protectee, the president just finished his speech, and you're walking him to the motorcade. Go. And I just looked at him. It's like he clicked his pen with his clipboard, like, yeah, right, here we go, you know, you're not going to make it. And it kind of made my blood boil a little bit. And it was that moment where I was like, you don't think I can do this. So I was like, watch me. You know, it was that moment in my head, like, that stubbornness did me well. I said, you know, I'll show you. And I had no idea that I had such a voice in me, or that I could hit so hard, or that I could be so aggressive. I had never been in a fight before in that regard. So that test was almost kind of a blur to me. It was just like I just went all out and screaming and yelling and, you know, fighting with all of my might, and it seemed like it went on forever and ever. And then finally they called stop, and I kind of took my first breath of the whole test, like, oh my gosh, it's over. And I kind of looked around, and everybody's just kind of standing there gaping at me. And so I'm like, oh no, is that good? Is that bad? Like, and one of my favorite classmates kind of gave me a little wink, like, you got this, you know, you're okay. So I kind of relaxed a little bit, and when I walked back over to the instructors, they just said I passed, and they gave me a score, and I didn't hear it. All I heard was passed, and I was like, oh my gosh, you know, I have to come back tomorrow and keep doing this. But it was that pivotal moment in training where I realized I'm not going to get anywhere positive in this experience if I stay within my comfort zone, which is to be quieter. And it was after that moment that I've started to more excel in training as opposed to be kind of holding back. And But anyways, it was kind of funny to watch my instructor or my instructors and my classmates when we were going back to our rooms that night. They were like, "Mel, I have never seen that." But he said, "I will protect anybody with you any day now."
Now, so, you know, anyone who's not been in this type of training, you put a even an average, but of course a larger than average person in this red man suit. It's a pretty imposing figure. I mean, it's pretty frightening. Even though they're on your side and it's for training. So once you received your badge, Melanie, was it the kind of thing where people, once you got out, people know she earned it. She's right. Like the rest of us. She, you know, she's a female, but all, you know, that's all the past now.
Right. I would say, you know, I kind of say in training, I kind of felt like people maybe minimized me because of my age more than my gender. But when I got in, out of training, I obviously had passed the same tests that everybody else had passed. But then you kind of feel a little bit of the more the gender kind of thing. You know, you find yourself in positions where, you know, you might not be at the most visible post when you're, you know, at a, say, a campaign rally. I was hired in 2007, so my first year out of training was the 2008 presidential campaign, which we all know that Obama-McCain campaign season was absolutely nuts. Mm-hmm. So I got a lot of experience, but I would find like, oh, I'm kind of, you know, backstage, or, you know, you always feel like you're not getting the exposure because maybe they think you're just not as experienced or you can't handle it. But my work ethic has always been 100%. I'm always that kind of, you know, personality. So I worked really hard my first couple years out of training trying to establish this work ethic that, you know, I can do this. I may not have the most experience, but I'm going to give it my all, and I'm going to get that experience one way or the other.
Now, Melanie, let me ask this. I mean, part of the role of Secret Service agents is you want to be discreet. You need to have a presence, but you don't necessarily want folks to know that, hey, there's Melanie, she's a Secret Service agent. Do you think it was an advantage for you to be young and female?
Right. I do think so. There were the Secret Service doesn't just work the protection aspect. They do the investigative aspect as well, counterfeit currency, fraud. And in the Los Angeles field office, it's a large field office, you know, high population, so there was never a shortage of investigations or protection assignments in Los Angeles. But I found I had an advantage in the investigative realm by being female because I could blend in better in surveillances. Nobody suspected, you know, this 20-something-year-old blonde girl to be this Secret Service agent. So there's a kind of a funny story about that. For a counterfeit case, I was asked to assist with a surveillance. The suspects were going to Las Vegas and passing a lot of this counterfeit currency in Las Vegas. And Los Angeles is just a, you know, shortish drive out there. So I was out, went out there, and the suspects went into one of the casinos, and I still looked very young, and so I'm kind of following this guy around a little bit, around the casino, kind of just, you know, laying low, but I kept getting stopped by security, because they said, "Hey, honey, you're not allowed to be in here, you're not old enough, or let me see some ID." And I'm like, oh my gosh, you know, so I have to get the, you know, eyeball some one of my colleagues and be like, hey, can you take over for a second, you know, kind of thing. So I ended up just having to go to the security office every day when I started my surveillance shift and ask for those wristbands, you know, if, hey, I'm old enough. But those kind of things, people wouldn't suspect me. And on the protection side, I found that I had an advantage when a protectee would want to do something kind of low key. You know, they live such public lives. They can't even go to, you know, the grocery store without a Secret Service person following them around. And, you know, so you think about that, you know, maybe they want that private moment once in a while. And Jill Biden, Joe Biden's wife, came into Los Angeles one time and she wanted to go for a run on the beach in, near Santa Monica, you know, run the boardwalk. But she's like, I don't want it to be this big gaggle of people. I just want to be low-key, just go for a morning jog before I have to give my speech later, yada, yada. Well, they called me to go running with her. And that was probably one of my most fun experiences, is that I got to go, you know, I have my gear on, I just have a baggy T-shirt, and it's me and Jill Biden and another younger-looking guy from the office went behind, and we were able to allow, you know, a noteworthy or you know, recognizable figure to have a quiet moment. So those kind of instances, I always felt like I had something to offer. You know, I can make this happen, person. And so those instances I was always grateful for because I felt I had something meaningful to offer.
Now, Mel, I know this is one of those things where there's probably questions you can't answer, but in cases like that, who is the final authority? I mean, can the Secret Service actually tell one of these people, no, you are not going running on the beach, end of discussion? Or do you have to just sort of grit your teeth and figure out how to make it work?
Well, I think they do have those conversations, but those were way above my pay grade. So I'm not sure how that went down in the Joe Biden instance, but I know that, you know, certain people probably wouldn't be able to do that. Maybe, you know, the president may have a harder time making that happen. But it definitely is one of those things where supervisors get involved and we work out something to make it safe for everyone.
Okay, and so I guess what I'm hearing, it's interesting to me, it sounds like your life experience being someone used to being in the background started to serve you very well as a Secret Service agent.
I think so. You know, sometimes we think our strengths are our weakness, but, you know, in some cases it benefited me, you know, getting my life experience in that way.
Okay, two quick questions. Who decides or how do they assign the code names for a protectee? Who decides whether, you know, President Reagan's, I don't know, what was Nancy Reagan's code name?
Rainbow.
Rainbow. Who chose that?
You know what, I honestly, I don't know.
Okay.
I know that they kind of go a bit back and forth to make sure it's a word that can't really be confused on the radio. Mm. You know, rainbow is kind of easy. You know, you're not going to mishear that on the radio. But they're always kind of fun. They're, you know, I'm not giving away anything to say her code name was Rainbow or whatever. But yeah, you know what? I really don't know who does that, who makes that final determination.
So Ben gets normally one dumb question per interview. I'm going to take two this time. So we're coming up on our break here, Melanie. Folks, we're interviewing Melanie Lentz. She's a former Secret Service agent. Melanie, think about this over the break. Because I really, really need an answer on this. What is the deal with those cuff microphones? I mean, if you're trying to be discreet, anytime I see somebody talking into their sleeve, I know they're a Secret Service agent. So I want an answer to that when we come back. Stick around, folks. You can hear this and other podcasts, AmericanWarriorRadio.com. We'll be right back.
Those who expect to reap the blessings of freedom must, like men, undergo the fatigue of supporting it. Now, back to the American Warrior.
Welcome back to American Warrior Radio, ladies and gentlemen. This is your host, Ben Bueller Garcia. We're joined by former Secret Service agent Melanie Lentz. She's got a book coming out. We're going to talk a little bit about that. But you can also learn more about Melanie. Visit MelanieLentz.com, L-E-N-T-Z. Melanie, gave you a quiz question before the break. What is up with those cuff mics?
I know. They are obnoxious, aren't they? I hated wearing mine on my cuff. I thought that cord that's going all up your arm and stuff and around and hooked to the back of you and stuff like that, I thought that was kind of annoying. So I always kind of wore mine over my shoulder. So I was the agent reaching into my coat to grab the dangling microphone to talk on it. But I don't know. You'd think we'd have something a little more sophisticated by now. But
I'm just saying.
Maybe they do.
Well, speaking of sophisticated, we're hearing a beep on occasion. Melanie, are you recording us? Is the Secret Service monitoring American Warrior Radio?
No.
Or am I just being paranoid?
No, I'm just standing here on my landline.
Okay, all right. Just checking. I want to be sure. Let's talk a little bit about your time with Nancy Reagan, Rainbow. That must have been a very interesting time for you. Maybe taking this a little bit out of order, but I introduced a show mentioning that you were the only agent allowed or present in the embalming room when they embalmed Mrs. Reagan. Why was an agent necessary to be present at that point?
Right. Well, when I became a Secret Service agent, I never thought that that would be something I would have to watch. But when you think about it, when a protectee passes away, it's not like we just bail. You know, we don't just leave. And I guess I just wasn't prepared for that at the time. So we protected her until she was laid to rest, next to Mr. Reagan at the Reagan Library. So it was definitely a very difficult couple days. I definitely didn't wake up that morning thinking I was going to have to mentally prepare myself for that. And it was definitely a big, her death was definitely a big catalyst to a lot of changes in my life, and we can talk about that a little bit more. My relationship with Nancy Reagan was very minimal. After 8 years in the Los Angeles field office, agents typically spend a few years in the field, and then they transfer to Washington, D.C., or to one of the former president's details around the country for your protection phase of your career, where you do protection full-time. In the field, you do investigations and protection. And so when it was my turn to go to phase two, as they called it, to go to protection, I was obviously in Los Angeles. I had gotten married by that point. My husband's job was in LA County. He was a police officer there. So the best move for my personal life, which is always a big juggle as a Secret Service agent with relocating being kind of mandatory, was to try to stay in Los Angeles on Nancy Reagan's protection detail, because she was lived in the ritzy Bel Air area and was still, you know, healthy and active. So I put in to go there, and I was given the spot, and I was having a lot of personal problems in my personal life. Every honest Secret Service agent will tell you that balancing your personal and professional life is almost impossible, because your job demands flexibility, and you hope and pray every day that your loved ones will give you the same flexibility when, you know, holiday plans are canceled and things like that. And I will be the first to tell you that I didn't handle a lot of that well. I became, you know, this bright-eyed and bushy-tailed 22-year-old, you know, new agent. Over time, became a total workaholic. My personal life suffered. I was never home, angry, upset, and often having opposite work schedules from my spouse, who was also in law enforcement. So by the time I transferred to Nancy Reagan's detail in 2015, my personal life was on the rocks. The marriage was on the rocks. I hadn't handled a lot of things well. But I had this switch that a lot of law enforcement and military will tell you, you turn on the switch and you go to work and you put everything behind you. And that is a sustainable lifestyle for a long time, but it will catch up with you. And that was the case with me.
Natalie, it's not uncommon when we speak to particularly special forces personnel. We've got a former CIA agent coming on the show next week. You know, he says everybody I knew was divorced just because of the nature of the work. And it's not uncommon, I'm finding, that those who are assigned to protect others often ignore protecting themselves. And I've got a quote here I want to read to our listeners from something you wrote. It said, "I was trained to quickly spot security concerns in my professional life, but I missed the glaring jackals in my personal life."
Absolutely.
So, I mean, at that point, when the wheels are coming off in your personal life, I mean, we're in order to fulfill your professional duties and your commitment to the Secret Service, at which point do you start to say, okay, I need to get this taken care of?
Well, my life fell apart, and it kind of slapped me in the face in my case. It's one of those where I was only with Nancy Reagan for about 8 months, and I think when most agents, when they become an agent, they view themselves as going to Washington, D.C. and protecting the president or the vice president. You know, that's most people, you know, no offense to Mrs. Reagan, but most people don't get on the job thinking, oh, I want to go protect, you know, Mrs. Reagan, who's in her 90s. You know, that wasn't necessarily, I loved my job. I wanted to do, you know, move up and do what I was supposed to do career-wise. But it wound up being, going to Nancy Reagan's detail wound up being a huge blessing, because when my marriage was falling apart and I wasn't doing well, I wasn't traveling as much on Nancy Reagan's detail. I wasn't, you know, I was able to have a little more set schedule, that sort of thing. So it allowed me to start protecting myself. And I think that started after Mrs. Reagan passed away. You know, there are a lot of things in life that will prompt some life reflection, but standing in an embalming room for 2 days, that will prompt a lot of life reflection. Mm-hmm. And then being at her funeral, the official funeral that was televised, I was in the back of the room at my post, and I was listening to this woman, learning about this woman that I had protected for, you know, less than a year, but I didn't really know well. It was all professional, you know, logistics and where are we going and that sort of thing. But I learned about her. Everybody talked about her leaving a legacy of love. And I was in the middle of the divorce by then. I was standing in the back of the room realizing my legacy is not this, you know, go-getter 22-year-old anymore. I'm a mess, you know, and I need to make some changes. And the Secret Service kind of prompted that because I hadn't fulfilled my full protection time as an agent, with only being on Nancy Reagan's detail less than a year. So I got transfer orders to Washington, D.C., which that meant a big life decision I hadn't had to make on my own. I'd been married or in a relationship my whole adult life. And once Mrs. Reagan passed away and I got these transfer orders, and I had a lot of reflection to do and learning about Nancy Reagan and realizing I wanted to leave a different legacy than I was headed. I was very depressed, very sad. I was getting divorced. I'm not that kind of person. You know, I said, I'm not this person. Mm-hmm. And I ended up leaving the agency, and that was one of the most difficult decisions I ever made in my life. But I realized how much, if I stayed trainable in my 30s like I was in my 20s, I learned a lot about life from the Secret Service, and that was that I had neglected to protect myself when I had the options, and it was time to start doing that now. And it wasn't too late for me. So that process is what sparked writing the book.
Melanie, we're coming up on another break, and I found it very interesting in reading some of your stuff. There's some very interesting practical lessons that you learned where you apply some of the rudimentary is not the right word, but the practices that are applied in the Secret Service, and you started to translate those and apply them to your personal life. I want to talk about that, but I want to give it some more time after the break. So before we do that, though, tell us, you do have a book coming up pretty soon. Tell us a little bit more about what folks should expect to read there.
Right. I wrote about my experiences in the Secret Service. The book is called Agent Innocent, and if all goes well, it should come out sometime next year. And we'll have all the updates on my website and all that good stuff. But I'm excited about that process and for the book to come out.
And that website, folks, is melanielentz.com. Stick around. We've got one more segment with Secret Service agent Melanie Lentz.
My daddy served in the Army. We lost his right eye, but he flew a flag out in our yard. Till the day that he died, he wanted my mother, my brother, my sister, and me to grow up and live happy in the land of the free.
If you want to discuss those who serve the red, white, and blue, dial 520-751-1041. Now, back to the American Warrior.
Welcome back to American Warrior Radio. This is your host, Ben Bueller Garcia. We're joined by former Secret Service agent Melanie Lentz. You can find out more about Melanie, visit melanielentz.com. Melanie, before the break, in preparing for the show, I was reading some of your stuff online, and I found it really inspiring, frankly, that you were able to, in dealing with your situations in your personal life, you were able to take lessons from what you were taught as an elite professional in the Secret Service. And we've only got about 10 minutes left, so we can't get too much. And frankly, I want them to buy the book and read the book eventually, so let's not give too much away here. But you know, let's start off with access control. Explain to our listeners what that is in the Secret Service, and then how that applied in as you were trying to decide what to do in your personal life.
Right. Well, if you think about it, access control is really the fundamental element of protection in the Secret Service. You have to control who is allowed to get close to your protectee to ensure that they're safe at all times. But some people need access to the president. Let's say, for example, if he's going on, the Ellen DeGeneres show or something to that effect, you'll have somebody that will need to, you know, hook up the mic and things like that. So those people might need, you know, some limited access. So it's like this fine balance of who needs access, who doesn't need access, who maybe needs limited access, and whose access, you know, at what point do you revoke access? You know, for example, like throwing a shoe at the president during a rally or something, that would get your access revoked.
Not that that ever happens, but yeah.
Yes, of course. You know, that kind of thing. So you're always kind of, you know, who needs a name check? You know, it's access control is what makes your job successful and implementing that effectively on game day. So in my personal life, access control is also something that I didn't really practice well in my own life. I tended to be this perfectionist people pleaser. I allowed people to use me, or I allowed people to influence my sense of self-worth more than I should have allowed. And, you know, that resulted in a lot of toxic friendships, relationships, et cetera. And it affected me a lot because I think most people can relate. We have people in our lives that we probably allow to control our thoughts and maybe some of our actions too much. And I realized that as a woman starting over in my 30s, that it wasn't too late for me to start evaluating those relationships in my life and start, you know, having a little self-respect. You know, I liken access control to self-respect. I respect myself enough to protect myself and to recognize when something, a situation or a person is allowed to have negative access. But on the flip side of that, when I was going through the divorce and, you know, having to contemplate, am I going to quit my job or am I going to move? I tend to be that kind of introvert that withdraws a little bit and kind of revokes access to everyone, you know, shut everybody out. But you also have to know that sometimes positive access needs to be granted. You know, my family was always there for me during that time, but I went through a period where I pushed them all away. I've got this, you know, kind of thing, attitude.
Melanie, is that, when you say positive, does that include reaching out, admitting to yourself when you do need help and when you do need to open up and you're seeking out that person who can help?
Right, exactly, and that kind of goes with my next lesson about situation reports.
Mm-hmm.
Do you want me to? I'll go ahead and move on to
that
one. That's one of my other ones. Situation reports they're a military thing. I'm sure also, but in a Secret Service motorcade, the motorcade has to be in communication with the agents at the destination. So the agents at your destination, say it's a campaign rally. The agent at the destination will need to let you know, hey, you've got, you know, a peaceful demonstration 2 blocks north of the arrival point. You have the host committee or the CEO of wherever you're headed is going to greet you upon arrival. All that kind of stuff. You have, 10,000 people went through magnetometers inside the venue. You give them all these nuggets of things that the bosses and everybody needs to know when you arrive. And when you're pulling around that final corner, you're situation report or sit rep needs to be all clear for arrival or we're not coming.
Mm-hmm.
And with that, for me, sit reps in my personal life are kind of like self-awareness. I am really quick to say I'm fine because I think, you know, maybe I have to be tough as an agent. I can't allow my personal life to affect my work. So I'm just always going to be fine. I'm going to develop this switch where I just turn off all emotions, suppress, diffuse, avoid my personal problems, and leave that switch on indefinitely. But the problem is that if you give a dishonest situation report in a motorcade, then there could be some disastrous consequences. And if I give myself a dishonest sit rep when I say I'm fine, when in reality I'm really struggling with divorce and working 60 hours a week and these Los Angeles commutes and I'm not doing so well with all these new life changes, if I continue to say I'm fine, eventually that's going to catch up with me. The truth is going to come out eventually. And for me, I don't think law enforcement or even military, for that matter, talk enough about that kind of stuff, the personal life and what goes on behind the scenes. We always want to talk about the cool stuff that happens on the job. But in reality, behind the scenes, there are so many aspects of the job that are difficult to manage. And for me, I wound up having to eat a piece of humble pie, and I ended up calling the Secret Service Employee Assistance Program, which is that, you know, that program that they put on, you know, they put the flyer on the bulletin board, and you think it'll never apply to you.
Yeah.
You know, those things. But I end up going into the break room and finding this number and end up calling and saying, my life is falling apart. I need help. And I thought, oh, my gosh, I am going to be perceived as the weakest person in the world. You know, half the people I work with are divorced, you know, or half of them have their own personal problems going on. You know, I am so weak that I have to reach out and say, I need to talk to somebody.
Melanie,
I realize now, yeah?
Well, let me ask you this, because I know the military is really is trying much harder to make sure that the members of our military community feel comfortable when they have a need to go in and seek out help, but there's still, you touched on it there a little bit, there's still sort of a concern that that's going to go in my file, that's going to end my career. Do you feel the Secret Service, at least on the federal law enforcement side, that they're doing a little better job of that?
Oh, yes. You know, okay. I have all of the praise in the world to give to the Secret Service Employee Assistance Program. I was surprised. I was so shocked at how receptive and willing they were to help me. I mean, they had a counselor lined up for me to talk to within just a day or two. It was impressive to me that I was never judged. In fact, I was told, Melanie, you know, there are so many people in the same boat as you who are having the same life problems, and asking for help is not, that's not going to end your career, because I was worried. I said, is this going to, you know, are they going to take my clearance? Am I going to, you know, just say I'm going to counseling or something like that? And that never happened. I don't recall anyone ever giving me a bad time for saying I need help. And I applaud the Secret Service for hiring the people they have there, because it definitely, you know, I'm not exaggerating to say that experience changed the course of my life.
Well, sure.
Because I did ask for help.
Sure. So, I mean, short Reader's Digest version for any of the military or law enforcement or first responder listeners or their families out there listening to this program, Melanie Lentz absolutely 110% endorses getting help. I mean, that's pretty clear,
oh, yes.
Right?
100%, yes.
What for, on a practical standpoint, if folks just can't quite get there yet, if you were reaching out to just an individual to sort of bare your soul and seek help, do you think, Melanie, it is better to reach out to someone who is a fellow professional who will have a good sense of what you're going through? Or is it sometimes helpful just to, you know, call up a schlub like me who's got no concept but then is bringing a fresh pair of eyes to the situation?
It probably just depends on the situation, but for me, it was just somebody who just, I guess not unbiased, but just somebody who just didn't have not that they didn't care, but just somebody that just didn't know any different. They could just listen to the situation and look at it objectively. So I personally went to the professionals, and I found that was great. But also in talking to some of my peers, sometimes just talking about it with your peers, we don't bring those up because we all think we need to have it together and be tough all the time and stuff. But I found when I did talk about it and say, hey, you know, I'm going through this at home, and a lot of people, hey, I've been there. And you're like, well, I had no idea. You know, you find out you have more of a support system, or at least I realized I had a much bigger support system amongst my fellow coworkers and peers than I realized. So I'd say both.
Well, you know, good for you, Melanie, and good for you to have the courage to come out and communicate these messages, because I really do believe, in fact, we get emails and phone calls very often from people who've heard an interview and said, hey, that was me, and they gave me the courage to go ahead and take that step. Just about 2 minutes left before we have to end this. Melanie, just to clarify, because it sounds like you were definitely a true professional, so you never, you know, locked the keys in the limo or anything like that. Does that stuff ever happen?
Well, yes. I had an instance. Yes, I did have a quick instance. I'll close with this funny. Well, it wasn't funny at the time, but I was working at the UN General Assembly, United Nations General Assembly in New York City, which happens every September. And my particular assignment was a foreign head of state who wanted to go out to dinner, and it was a female prime minister. She went in to have dinner, and we were able to get our own dinner in the basement, so we were kind of rotating around. And we couldn't leave the cars outside or anything because they'd been swept and, you know, were clean, so I had to stay. So I went out and let the limo driver go inside and get something to eat. And, you know, I didn't want to just sit in the car. I kind of stood outside next to it. Well, I bumped the door, and it closed on me. And I, you know, that horrific feeling when you pull that handle and see the spare key had fallen out of your pocket on the seat. Luckily, God bless the New York Police Department, because they were able to get a car, one of their, ERT, their SWAT guy kind of unit to come and open that car door. But I definitely, you better believe, every time I had a protection assignment after that, I had about 5 spare keys scattered around amongst all the agents, just in case. But, those horrific moments that'll have you, this could go real bad, this is not good, but.
Melanie, thank you so much for your time, for joining American Warrior Radio. Folks, you can find out more, visit MelanieLentz.com. Find this podcast and others, AmericanWarriorRadio.com. You could even follow us on Facebook, American Warrior Radio, or at Twitter at Warrior Radio TUC. Until next time, all policies and procedures are to remain in place.
right weekend shows at the right time.
All of our weekend show info can be found at 1041kqth.com.
It's 1041kqth HD.
KQTH.